It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we're taking a look at the science of seduction, how the aromas of certain foods can set off all sorts of interesting reactions. Our guest is researcher Dr. Alan Hirsch. His discoveries may radically change romantic dinners. Would you believe men cannot resist the scent of pumpkin pie? Forget the Chanel. Jane and Michael Stern are in Salt Lake and root beer heaven at Hire's Big H. Wine maverick Joshua Wesson says Syrah is going to knock Merlot off its feet. Writer Calvin Trillin advises us on marital bliss and the dinner table. And we have a report on the Museum of Burnt Food. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide for nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. This past weekend, I made a batch of ginger snaps. I wanted to try a new recipe from a book that came out recently. It occurred to me how easy it is to personalize most cookie recipes with your own flavorings. Here's what I mean. This ginger snap recipe was going for real spicy ginger flavor. So it called for the usual ground ginger plus grated fresh ginger root. I knew that some black pepper and not too hot chili powder would heighten that spiciness even more. Extra vanilla would give it just the right mellow balance to keep those flavorings from going over the top. So I have some suggestions for how to improvise with basic cookie recipes. I'm talking about sugar cookies, any kind of chocolate chip, spice, or oatmeal cookie. Now, the first rule to remember is that more vanilla is usually a good thing. Vanilla equals mellow and rich. Just be sure to use real vanilla extract, not the imitation kind. That can leave a nasty aftertaste. Where most cookie recipes call for a teaspoon of vanilla, using 2 teaspoons improves the cookie. The other rule with vanilla is wherever there's lots of spices in a recipe, like ginger snaps or oatmeal cookies, 2 teaspoons of vanilla mellows and blends flavors. It makes the cookie taste a bit richer. That goes for anything with chocolate. Vanilla is the natural complement to chocolate. This is a perfect marriage. Now, speaking of chocolate, you can add chocolate chunks or chips to any recipe you'd like. The same goes for nuts or dried fruits. Just fold them in as the last step in making the dough, or press pieces into the cookies once they're on the cookie sheet. Now, if your baking consists of buying cookie dough in tubes and slicing it onto a baking sheet, you can still improvise with this idea of pressing ingredients into the cookies. Oatmeal cookies taste especially good with little bits of dried apricot or dried cherries instead of raisins. Try salted peanuts pressed into chocolate chip cookies. Speaking of peanuts, in scratch cookies, you could take a basic sugar cookie recipe and turn it into a great-tasting, crunchy peanut butter cookie. Cut back slightly on the butter and blend it with chunky peanut butter. Let's say the recipe calls for a stick of butter. Well, use 3/4 of a stick and add 1/2 cup of peanut butter. Now, here's where extra vanilla really shines. Also, stir in some whole salted peanuts into the dough as the last step when you're mixing everything together. Now, speaking of salt, be sure there's enough in your cookie recipe. Salt, used judiciously, makes cookies taste sweeter, and it brings out all kinds of flavors. I usually figure if the recipe calls for 2 cups of flour, I'll add a slightly rounded 1/4 teaspoon of salt. Let's go back to that basic sugar cookie. Usually the recipe begins with beating together butter and sugar. Well, you can make orange coconut cookies by beating into the butter some generous amounts of shredded orange zest. Add some orange juice to the dough, and then as that last step, fold in a lot of sweetened coconut. And if you want to really take this over the top, along with the coconut, fold in pieces of high-quality white chocolate. Some of the lightest cookies you can make are meringues, egg whites beaten with sugar until they form soft peaks. Now, sometimes some acid like lemon juice is added. Then the fluffy mixture is dropped on a cookie sheet and baked. Now, most basic cookbooks have a recipe for meringues. Well, when you make the meringues, sift some cocoa into the whites once they're thick and beat in vanilla. Then, before dropping them on the baking sheet, fold in chocolate chips. Then bake as directed in the recipe. So, improvise with some basic cookie recipes and join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where you'll find an exclusive selection of Corningware bakeware, including the classic French white line. Corningware can go from the freezer to the oven to the dinner table. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Today we take a look at love and food through the eyes of a scientist. Our guest is neurologist and psychiatrist Dr. Alan Hirsch. He's been researching aroma and arousal. He's going to tell us why the scents of certain foods stimulate passionate behavior. But it's often not the same for both men and women. Now, this interview has some mature language in it, so be warned. It's move over Merlot time. Did you know that this red wine almost beats out White Zinfandel in popularity? But the wine maven's carp, Merlot, is not serious enough. Well, our wine maverick, Joshua Wesson, has a new candidate for an easy-to-like red wine that's also held in pretty high regard by the experts. It's called Syrah, and there's some good drinking for not a huge amount of money. Joshua will name the names. Journalist and cultural commentator Calvin Trillin offers us the keys to a successful marriage between food lovers. And then later on, we talk with the creator of one of America's most significant and, dare I say, revealing artistic endeavors. We will be speaking with the director of the new Museum of Burnt Food. Then, as we do every week, we will be opening the lines for your calls in the second half of the show. The number is 800-537-5252. Right now, let's find out what Jane and Michael Stern have been up to. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, you know, we love old-fashioned drive-in restaurants, and one of our favorites, actually, four of our favorites, because there are four of them, is Heyer's Big H in Salt Lake City. This is a restaurant from the 50s, very literally from the 50s, but with the spirit of the 1950s about it.
I love that town. I was out there a couple of months ago. Great people and great food, but I didn't get to this place.
Well, one of the great things about it is its attitude. Right on the front of the menu, it says, if for any reason you are not satisfied with the food, drink, or service, please contact your server or the manager. Well, we've never had to do that, but it's a nice thought that we can if we need to.
I mean, it's the kind of place, Heyer's Big H, that if you describe it, it sounds, well, you know, what else is new? It's a drive-in, as Michael said, that serves, you know, big hamburgers and French fries and onion rings. But everything they do there is just somehow tastes better than it does anywhere else. I think maybe because you get a big frozen mug of root beer, along with root beer floats and a marshmallow chocolate malt, which comes with the Big
Ooh.
H burger, which is this just wonderful sourdough bread with a floury top with bacon, grilled onions, pickles, mayonnaise, lettuce and tomato, and just a really first-rate hamburger.
Now, if this sounds a little bit like the Big Mac, it is not. And in fact, another note on the menu reminds us why it is not. Because this is kind of a drive-in with an attitude. And I would say the attitude is maybe a little bit anti-McDonald's because they refer to the bun as something other than a preservative-enhanced, wilted crust studded with obnoxious seeds. This has no obnoxious seeds.
But, you know, let me tell you what else I like there, because, I mean, Michael is really the professor of hamburgerology of the two Sterns.
Thank you,
Jen. You're welcome, Jared. But I love the Hires Big H BLT, and also something called the Country Club, which is a white turkey meat sandwich with crisp bacon, lettuce, tomato, and cranberry sauce on good, really good toast. I mean, not just, you know, sort of smushy, white bread. It's almost something you would get at a ladies' tea room in the 1940s. But that's something that Michael and I both noticed about Salt Lake City, Utah, is the restaurants in Salt Lake really serve old-fashioned food, and I mean that in the best possible way. I mean, if you order turkey breast, you get an oven-roasted turkey breast. You don't get one of those, you know, abominable, you know, squished rolls, you know.
With obnoxious seeds.
Yeah, airplane turkey.
The other thing that must be mentioned, though, about Hires Big H, as you might infer from the name, is that root beer is a big deal here. And Jane said you get it with a big frosty mug of root beer. Well, you needn't get a big frosty mug of root beer because, in fact, there are 5 different sizes of root beer available, all the way from baby to large. So whatever your thirst is, you can slake it just perfectly.
And large is very discreet. They call it large. Anybody else would have called it, you know, dinosaur, deluxe, jumbo, gigando, you know, immenso. I mean, baby is a tiny little shot glass of root beer.
Now,
but large is gigantic.
But here's the big one, guys. Do I have to have a car to eat here?
Well, that's the joy of it. Absolutely not. In fact, when we called it a drive-in, what we meant is a drive-in style restaurant. In fact, dining is indoors at Easy Wipe for Mica tables.
Easy Wipe for Mica. Yes.
For the carless Lynn, it can be Hires Big H walk-in restaurant.
So now I've got another great place to go on my next trip to Salt Lake City. Hey.
Yeah, your favorite city.
Thank
Big
you,
H.
guys.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander to the world with me. And any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the road.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Square Meals, America's Favorite Comfort Food Cookbook. You can hear them here every week, but you can take a look at their road food finds anytime. Go to our website, splendidtable.org. Joshua Wesson is a wine expert who follows his own drummer. He believes wine isn't about snobbery or expense, but can be an everyday beverage, enjoyed with moderation. And he's always looking for a good buy. Joshua is the creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Hey, Joshua, welcome back.
I'm happy to be back, and I'm happy because I just came from an amazing tasting.
What were you tasting?
Tasting Syrah, the next big thing. The big, dark, juicy wave that's sort of washing all over us now.
Is you mean this is going to be the wine that's going to knock Merlot out of the ring?
Well, I'm counting on it. You know, I mean, I voted for Gore, so what can I say? Not exactly the great predictor here. But I will say this. Syrah, Shiraz, whatever it's called, same grape, is I think, positioned to be the next great red grape. Everybody, you know, hyped Merlot, and we were drinking Merlot largely because it wasn't Cabernet, because it didn't hurt you. It was through negation that people gravitated to Merlot. But the great thing about Syrah is that you go there because you like what it's doing. It's for positives, not negatives, that people end up drinking this, loving this. And it's, you know, one of the hottest grapes, not just in France, where it really achieved its first you know, great expression in the Rhone, but in Australia, where it's the most widely planted red grape, and in California, where it has put, you know, a lot of Rhone Rangers on the map, and people are loving Shiraz because it's not Cabernet, it's not Merlot, it has its own style and its own flavor, and it's a wonderful wine. Happy
All right,
wine.
You have Shiraz and Syrah.
Right. Well, you know, the origins of the grape are clouded in legend and mystery, and people don't really know where it came from, but they believe that the original description of the grape was Shiraz, alluding to its origins in Persia or Iran, where there's a city called Shiraz.
Uh-huh.
Now, somehow, this Shiraz vine from the city of Shiraz was dragged up to France, and it got planted in the Rhone, in the southern part of France, because there's one thing that's indisputable. It is a grape and a vine that loves the sun, and it grows best in places where it's warm and dry, and that describes the Rhone to a T.
Okay, but what does it taste like?
Well, you know, it's a grape. When we go into the sun, we get tan. When grapes go in the sun, they get thicker skins. And because it's a sun-loving grape, it produces thick skin, rich, full-flavored red wines that don't have as much tannin that makes your mouth pucker up like Cabernet. And they add to the usual mix of red grape flavors like cherries and berries, an element of spiciness, especially cracked black pepper spice, which you tend not to find in Merlot or Cabernet Sauvignon. And then it delivers the goods because it tends to be a little bit fruitier and a little bit easier to drink than Cabernet and sometimes Merlot.
Okay, so give us some names of some to look for.
Well, I mentioned that it's the most widely planted grape, red grape, in Australia. And the Aussies are just, are wild for this stuff. And the style of Shiraz in Australia, and they call it Shiraz, not Syrah, is very fruity and scented with berries and sometimes anise, black pepper, allspice, nutmeg, clove, cinnamon. One of my favorites for easy drinking, almost guzzling Shiraz, is made by Wolf Blass. It comes from South Australia, and it's about $12, and it's a stunning little glass of red.
Mm. Okay, some others?
You know, France, of course, you want to go back to the mother country, but I like Syrahs that come from even farther south than the Rhone. And if you go down straight south of the Rhone, not too far because you'll end up in the Mediterranean,
yeah.
You hang a right, and then you head towards Spain, you'll end up in the Languedoc, which is one of the emerging regions of France that is producing tremendous high-quality wines at relatively low prices. And there's a producer there named Bois de Renard that makes a 100% Syrah from old vines grapes. And the stuff is just incredibly delicious to drink. It's got all the spice and all the subtlety and all the nuance of some famous Syrah-based wines from the Rhone, but it doesn't have the price. It's only about $10 a bottle, and it's really delicious stuff.
Anything from the United States?
Yeah, one of my favorites. In fact, I use this as one of the most reliable red wines coming out of California. It's made by Cupe, Q-U-P-E, and it comes from the Central Coast. And it is it's just full of life. It's full of goodness. All the reasons that people move to California are in a glass of Coupe Syrah.
Oh, I love it. Hey, Josh, thanks.
Oh, my pleasure.
Joshua Wesson is president of Best Sellers Wine Shops. You can find his Syrah suggestions on our website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, a scientist's take on aroma and arousal, Calvin Trillin on the fine art of marriage and food, and your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family. Just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. The next 10 minutes or so of the show are only for a mature audience. There will be some specific language about male anatomy. So this is a great time for all the young ones who are listening to take a break and maybe go to the kitchen and make a sandwich. Now, you know, there's a scientific reason why you bring your date a box of chocolates and why the all-time most popular date is going out to eat. Foods often associated with seduction. According to our guest, there's another reason for that. It's scent. What we smell and how we react to it. Our guest is the neurologist and psychiatrist, Dr. Alan Hirsch. He researches smell and taste at the Smell and Taste Treatment and Research Foundation in Chicago. His book is Scentsational Sex. It's about the sexual response to scent. Supposedly, certain aromas in foods can affect us in some surprising ways. Dr. Hirsch, welcome.
Hello.
Is there really a connection between aroma and arousal? I mean, what's the science here?
Well, actually, there is. There's a direct connection between the olfactory bulb at the top of the nose and the septal nucleus of the brain, which is the arousal center. For instance, if you stimulate that in a squirrel monkey, the squirrel monkey develops an erection. So anatomically, there's this direct connection between smell and sexual arousal. And you know, we talk about love at first sight. We really should be talking about love at first sniff, because it has a more direct approach to sexual arousal than any of the other sensory modalities.
Why are we set up that way?
Well, smell is a very primitive sensation, and it is of such importance that over 300 genes in the Human Genome Project have already been identified relating to smell far more than any of the other sensory modalities. You smell a smell, and you immediately decide, I like it or I don't like it. It gives you a direct affective emotion, totally different than all the other sensory modalities. So, you know, for instance, you'll see a picture of a cow or a tree or a horse, you'll identify it, and then you'll decide if you like it or not. Mm-hmm. With smell, it's exactly the opposite. You'll immediately decide, I like it or I don't, and then you'll figure out what it is. I guess a good example in the non-olfactory sphere, have you ever been in a classroom and somebody's taken their fingernails and scratched it down a chalkboard, and all of a sudden your hair stands on end and you become hyper-awake and hyper-alert?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Does that make any logical sense? I mean, when was the last time you were attacked by a chalkboard? But there's an example where sound induces change in emotions totally independent of thought. Well, the same thing happens with smell, except it happens all the time.
Now, was this for protection? Was it for procreation?
Well, actually, it was for both things. You know, we yawn as we're about to fall asleep. And as we yawn, we get more air into our mouth and more air into our nose. And hence, we are able to detect if there are any predators there about to attack us. So we know if it's safe to sleep or not. Likewise, being able to smell allows us to detect any potential pheromones that are present, suggesting that we might find a mate and having successful procreation. So smell is important for survival of the species.
Let's talk about food, because you talk about in the book that scents of certain foods have an effect on us. I think considering the time of year, I'd like to have sort of a hands-on how-to guide. Are there certain foods that spell disaster when it comes to romance?
Well, you know, I can tell you that when we studied odors and sexual arousal, the reason we began to look at this is in treating patients who lost their sense of smell, we found that 18% developed sexual dysfunction. So the idea came up that odors and sexual arousal were integrally related, And we're not the first ones to describe this. Freud, almost 100 years ago, said that in order to remain a civilized society, we had to repress our olfactory instincts. Otherwise, we'd walk around sexually excited all the time. So what we did is we set out to explore how smells could act to induce sexual arousal. And what we did is we measured penile blood flow of medical students. And we studied all sorts of different floral smells and perfumes. And as a control, an odor that I thought would have no effect at all, we threw in the smell of baked cinnamon buns. And lo and behold, the baked cinnamon buns had a greater effect than all the perfumes put together. I have to say, I wasn't sure what to make of that. It could just mean that medical students are always hungry. You don't know in that group. So we then studied males in the general population ages 18 to 64, and we studied a whole bunch more food items and colognes and perfumes and the like. And we found the number one odor that enhanced penile blood flow was actually a combination of lavender and pumpkin pie. Number two was a combination of donuts and black licorice, and number three was a combination of pumpkin pie and donuts. Although there was individual variation, so the older the man, the greater the engorgement with vanilla. Those who were most sexually satisfied had the greatest increase with strawberry, and those with the most frequent sexual intercourse had the greatest increase with lavender, oriental spice, and cola. Now, to give you an idea of what sort of changes these were, well, perfumes increased penile blood flow by a median of 3% as compared to 5% for cheese pizza, 9% for buttered popcorn, and 40% for lavender and pumpkin pie.
I have a feeling there's going to be a rush in the United States in the supermarket for lavender and pumpkin pie. But you're talking about arousal in men.
Well, that's right. We actually did the homologous study as well, looking at what odors induced female sexual arousal. And what we found was the number one odor that enhanced women's sexual arousal was actually a combination of Good and Plenty and cucumber, although Good and Plenty and banana nut bread also had very positive effects.
What a salad! Good and Plenty and cucumber salad!
Well, that's right. Now, I have to tell you that there were differences between men and women. In men, every single odor we tested enhanced penile blood flow. I guess it suggests it's a very resilient organ. But in women, we found differences. In women, there were some odors that inhibited female sexual arousal. For instance, the smell of cherries had a negative effect. The smell of barbecued roasted meat and the smell of men's cologne all inhibited female sexual arousal.
Well, that blows an entire industry right there.
Well, you know, I have to tell you a funny story. Is after we did these studies, we'd mixed up this Good and Plenty and cucumber mixture.
Right.
We couldn't keep it in the office because the medical students kept stealing it. So actually, a perfume company now about a month ago has come out with a perfume called Sexual Arousal, S.A., based on the studies. And they actually, it is available, and they have a website at www.esexualarousal.com.
So you're saying it's Good and Plenty, and cucumber is the basis of that cologne?
And that's right, Good and Plenty and cucumber. And there's other things, though, that having to do with smell that are really very relevant and having to do with foods. For instance, people may want to do things to enhance the romantic relationship, for instance, at dinner. And what we found is that if you serve garlic bread along with a pasta dinner, it enhances positive interactions by 8% and reduces negative interactions by 22%. So having the smell and the taste of the garlic bread along with dinner actually enhances the communication, and then you may get secondary effects later on.
Who knew? The one food you think you would avoid for a romantic dinner, garlic bread.
Well, that's right. Now, I have to say that just because you have garlic bread for dinner doesn't necessarily mean that people want the smell of garlic on their breath. We did a study looking at what people wanted their spouses or their dates kiss to taste like. And we looked at 100 married men, 100 single men, 100 married women, 100 single women. And what we found was that the married woman and the single woman wanted their husbands or their dates kissed to taste fresh, clean, like toothpaste, minty.
Mm-hmm.
The married men similarly described that they preferred their wife's kiss to taste minty or spearmint-like. The single men said they preferred their dates kissed to taste like alcohol.
Well, anybody who's been to college can understand that. Dr. Hirsch, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Alan Hirsch is a neurologist and psychiatrist. He is neurological director of the Smell and Taste Treatment and Research Foundation in Chicago. His latest book is What Flavor is Your Personality? You can get our picks for romantic dining in a special Valentine's Day menu that I've designed for our listeners. It's called Simple Seduction in Three Courses. And I suggest that you cook it together. I've got to admit, I did the menu before talking to Dr. Hirsch. I could have targeted it a little more next year. You can get the menu on our website. It's splendidtable.org. People navigate the minefields of marriage in many different ways. We all have our quirks that our partners have to live with. Successful marriages incorporate those quirks into everyday life. Writer Calvin Trillin shares his marriage expertise with a tale of marriage and meals.
Now that it's fashionable to reveal intimate details of married life, I can state publicly that my wife, Alice, has always had a weird predilection for limiting our family to three meals a day. I also might as well admit that the most serious threat to our marriage came in 1975, when Alice mentioned my weight just as I was about to sit down to dinner at a New Orleans restaurant named Chez Helene. I hardly need add that Chez Helene was one of my favorite restaurants in New Orleans. We do not have the sort of marriage that could come to grief over ordinary food. Without wanting to be legalistic, I should mention that Alice brought up the weight issue during a long-distance telephone call, breaking whatever federal regulations there are against interstate appetite impairment. Like many people who travel a lot on business, I'm in the habit of calling home every evening to share the little victories and defeats of the day. The triumph, for instance, of happening upon a superior tamale stand in a town I thought had long before been completely carved into spheres of influence by McDonald's and Burger King. Or the misery of being escorted by some local booster past the unmistakable aroma of genuine hickory wood barbecuing into the sort of restaurant I've always referred to as La Maison de la Casa House. Having found myself on business in New Orleans, or as it is sometimes expressed around my office, having found it my business to find business in New Orleans, I was about to settle into Chez Helene for a long evening. First, of course, I telephoned Alice in New York. I assumed it would give her great pleasure to hear that her husband was about to have enough sweet potatoes and fried oysters to make him as happy as he could manage to be outside her presence. Scholars of the art often mention Chez Helene as an example of what happens when Creole blends with soul, so that a bowl of greens comes out tasting of spices that the average greens maker in Georgia or Alabama probably associates with papists or with the devil himself. I'm about to have dinner at Chez Helene, I said. Dr. Seligman just told me today that you weighed 180 pounds when you were in his office last week, Alice said. That's terrible. There must be something wrong with this connection, I said. I could swear I just told you that I was about to have dinner at Chez Helene. You're going to have to go on a diet. This is serious. I said, I think there might be a better time to talk about this, Alice. Toward the end of the second or third term of the Caroline Kennedy administration was the sort of time I had in mind. Well, we can talk about it when you get home, Alice said. Have a nice dinner. I did. It is a measure of my devotion to Alice that I forgave her, even though my second order of fried chicken was ruined by the realization that I had forgotten to tell her I had actually weighed only 166 pounds. I always allow 14 pounds for clothes.
Calvin Trillin writes for Time Magazine and The Nation. Fans of Trillin's work will be happy to know the entirety of the Tummy Trilogy is now available on audio tape. Read by the author, no less. Call me, call me, call me, call me, call me. Ain't nothing going right. The lines are officially open for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have Alan. Alan, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, I just wanted to ask you, I come from, I was born in Tunisia and I lived in France. And in Tunisia, we have the main national staple dish is the couscous.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
But it's not eaten as a kind of health food type of little side dish. It's the basis of a main course. There's a lot of vegetables. There's a lot of different meats that go around or inside. There are meatballs that we do. And the whole meal is surrounded with little salad, spicy and tangy and this kind of thing.
But the couscous
it's the whole
is...
ceremony, almost.
And the couscous is sort of the center of the table. It's the
it's
thing
the
that...
It's the center of the table. And it's in my family, when I grew up... I mean, all my child and adolescent life, it was every Friday night, there was a couscous, no matter what, winter, summer, whatever, it's couscous is the dish. But here's my question. When the French, who know, I think, a lot about about food, discovered couscous, it became a national dish also within years after the French came back from Algeria, it was in restaurants, now it's in institution, in schools, I mean, whatever there is a menu for, it has become a staple. They really have adopted it. In America, it seems that people really didn't get that. They considered that as a, as a, you know, like a side dish.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, well, instead of potatoes tonight, we'll have couscous.
Yeah.
Or we'll make a couscous salad and we'll serve it on a buffet.
And that's it. What do you think is the reason for that?
You mean why?
Yeah.
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons, but I think the prime one is the difference between France's experience with it and we Americans' experience with it. France occupied Tunisia. Am I remembering this correctly?
Yeah, that's right.
In so many words, the culture of your country was partially adopted by the French. And the couscous came to France as a part of absorbing another culture. In this country, and this happens with a lot of foods from other places, it's we pick up the food, but we don't pick up the culture. It's, you know, it's just the nature of the way the world has worked out that I think most people are totally unfamiliar with any of the countries in North Africa. You know, as I have no doubt, most of us don't really know very much about your country. And so I don't think they fully understand the context of the food.
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. And it's sad because it's such a versatile and basic type of food where you can do anything with it.
And it's
from
light.
From the sweet to the salty to the... the tart to the herbs to everything.
Well, you know, I don't know if you're familiar, but there is a writer who has, I think, given couscous at least part of its due, and it's Paula Wolfert.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, and she did a book a long time ago on the foods of Morocco and has written extensively on couscous.
Yeah. What is strange to me is that I saw how fast it picked up in France and how it spread out. It has become in a few years, and I've been here in the state for 20 years, and there were already when I came, you know, I could find in stores, food store, in natural health food store, couscous, but it never spread out.
I think it's still too strange to people. I think, and I agree with you, I make it, it's quick, it's delicious, and it's this wonderful backdrop to everything else.
Yep.
But you know what? Food trends keep changing in this country. You may see it suddenly come to the fore. So, you know, don't lose hope.
Okay.
And thank you. Thanks for the education.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for our trivia question of the week, and this one's about baby food. What are Gerber's two top-selling baby foods in Japan? We'll be back in a moment with the answer, artistic expression at the Museum of Burnt Food, and more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We have open lines for your calls this hour, so give us a ring. The number is 800-537-5252, and we will talk. But before getting back to the lines, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. It was about how an American company sells baby food in a very different culture. Here it is. What are Gerber's two top-selling baby foods in Japan? Well, the top two selling flavors are rice with chopped burdock root and sardines ground up in a white radish sauce. Which brings up the question of how much a culture shapes our taste preferences. Evidently, the answer is profoundly. You know, I remember a friend who was raised in India telling me she couldn't understand why American children love sweets so much. She said she and all her friends used to sneak the sour, fruity-tasting tamarind out of their mother's kitchens as a forbidden snack. Sour was the flavor they all loved. Well, speaking of sweet, the British are up there right near the top of the list when it comes to how much sugar they eat. And since baby food is on the agenda today, the latest innovation in England is baby food that tastes good to parents with more complex flavors. Since strawberry cheesecake baby food scored big 2 years ago, the British will be seeing lemon meringue pie and other adult-tasting desserts hitting the market. Nothing like giving that old sugar addiction a head start. Okay, back to the phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who's been patiently waiting on the line. We have got Babette. So, Babette, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn. Hey, you know what? I called you a couple months ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Perfect timing that I called after that man just talking about couscous, who sounded very handsome, I have to say. Nothing like an accent on a man.
Didn't he? Didn't he? I mean, didn't you want to just invite him over to dinner?
He sounded quite interesting. Anyway, I tried to make preserved lemons, and I had followed a recipe that had them soaking in a salt brine.
That's right, yeah.
And then we talked about, you gave me that great recipe for a chicken tangine with preserved lemons.
Right, that's the Moroccan stew of chicken and preserved lemons, essentially. Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
So I go to do that, and I reach my hand into the preserved lemons, and they are mush.
You're kidding.
No, they're not supposed to be mushy.
Wait, do you mean that? Okay, let's explain to everybody what we're talking about. You take a whole lemon, you cut little slashes in it.
Right.
So you've got the skin and all, and essentially you put it into a very heavily salted water and salt mixture.
Right.
And that's it. And you let that sit there for about 4 or 5 weeks.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be kind of, it's supposed to still be lemon peelish texture, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So these are just rotten. So what did I do you think?
I haven't done this in a long time, but I think I know what went wrong. I think it wasn't enough salt. Do you remember your proportion by any chance?
I don't. I remember thinking it didn't seem like enough salt, though.
My thought is, because the thing is, salt is the preservative there. And I don't know if you heard the person who called about how does it work when you brine stuff. But essentially, you're brining those lemons. And the idea is that if what's inside a cell is very, very dense, and you surround it with something that isn't as dense, like watery mixture, that cell will act like a suction cup. It will draw in that moisture. If it's the reverse, if whatever density there is in the cell, let's say the cell naturally has protein in it or whatever, and the mixture you put outside it is pure salt, for instance, then the suction works in the opposite direction. The denser material draws out the less dense material.
Right, which is what you want.
That's, well, essentially, yeah. And I think maybe what we've got here is you need a lot more salt in the water.
Should I go?
I think the authority on this, to me, is Paula Wolford.
Okay.
And the book is an old book, but it's still, I think it's still out there. It may be out in paperback. It's called Couscous and Other Good Food from Morocco.
All right, I'll go check that out.
Yeah. I'm sorry I couldn't help you more, Babette. But
okay.
Slimy lemons.
Slimy lemons.
Yeah. No.
I was going to give them as Christmas gifts.
To people you hate.
Needless to say, I did some shopping.
Hey, thanks for the call. Sorry we couldn't do more for you.
Thank you.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. and the lines are open for your calls. Let's see, who's up next? Who has been waiting patiently? We've got Ben on the line. Ben, what is up? What would you like to discuss?
Hi, Lynn. I've got a quick question here. I haven't been living in Minnesota long, and I started hunting this year, small game birds and such, and I actually got a couple pheasant when I was out in North Dakota.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering what I should do with them.
So now where are they? Are they hanging in the garage or are they in the freezer at this point?
No, they're in the freezer.
They're in the freezer. And the feathers are gone?
And they're all clean.
Okay, they're ready to go. Do they look like they're young pheasant or, shall we say, more mature pheasants?
These were pretty big birds, so I'm guessing they're pretty mature.
The first time I ever made pheasant, I should tell you this, I learned the hard way that pheasant legs and thighs on a mature pheasant, if you just roast them the way you would a chicken, it can taste as though the pheasant has been developing rubber bands for most of its life. It's like sheer iron. This is what I think you should do with them to really do them justice. The breast is going to taste great if you just cook it through, because it's going to be the most tender part of the bird.
Sure.
The legs and the thighs, you want to stew or braise. Cook them real slow until, you know, they're tender and they're almost coming off the bone. Now,
okay.
And that means you can do one of two things. I mean, you can actually serve them in a meal as two slightly different approaches to the same thing. You know, so everybody has one taste and then another taste. Or you can serve one night and one the other. But what I would do is, first of all, take the breasts off the bone.
Yep.
All right. And I would just rub into them some garlic and shallots and some olive oil and some fresh rosemary.
Wow.
This is a combination that will never hurt anything.
Okay. More garlic, the better, frankly.
Well, I agree with you. I agree with you. I mean, short of putting this on ice cream, trust me, Ben, this is going to be a very good deal. So do that and stick them in the fridge for a couple of hours.
Okay.
You know, just the idea is you want to permeate them with that flavor. In the meantime, if you feel like getting fancy, you can take the wings and all of those bones that you have from the breast, and you can put them in a pan with celery, carrot, and onion, and some white wine and water, and you can make a broth that you'll turn into a sauce.
That's normally what I do with all my bones.
This is a good you're a great cook. You do a lot of this, huh?
I wish I had more time to, but alas, I'm traveling all the time now, so I only get to do it on weekends.
Okay. All right. Well, this is one where you can do that ahead if you want to. Now, when it comes to the legs and thighs, what you can do is brown them in whatever choice of fat you have, you know, whatever you'd like, but make it something with flavor.
Right.
And then add some celery and carrot and onion. And in this case, I do something a little different. You know, I do something like tarragon or dill and maybe some mustard seed that you've sautéed, and I'd let that cook with red wine. And let them simmer gently in that red wine. You could throw in little pearl onions if you wanted. You could use diced up bacon that you've browned and add it toward the end. I mean, you could make something like a coq au vin kind of dish out of this. You could put wild mushrooms if you wanted in there.
My mouth is watering.
Well, you get the idea. You're making a stew out of the legs, and you're making essentially a pan-sautéed breast. And when you go to cook the breasts, you'll cook them in a little bit of fat in a shallow pan. You'll sear them over high heat. You'll then turn the heat down, cook them about 6 to 7 minutes per side until they're firm when you press them. Okay?
Okay.
You'll lift them out of the pan. You'll keep them warm. You'll throw that nice broth that you made, and you boil it down to almost nothing. And it will be so syrupy and luscious, and you'll slice the breasts, and you'll pour that sauce over. It'll just be a few spoonfuls. And then after that, you'll serve up your luscious, braised, out-of-this-world, outrageous legs and thighs.
About greens to go alongside this? I was thinking either some nice spinach or maybe asparagus.
I think something crispy like asparagus, because you've already got these soft, you know, mellow kinds of things. So cook greens too similar. Green beans, asparagus, crunchy broccoli, and something green, you know, or crisp cabbage. This my classic cabbage. You chop up the cabbage, you drop it in heavily salted boiling water, cook for 2 minutes, drain it, toss it with a little Spanish sherry vinegar, salt, and pepper.
Sounds great.
And serve it at room temperature and with something lush like those legs in a sauce, you know, that you've cooked them and cooked them.
Oh, yeah.
This is going to be food to die for.
I can't wait.
Yeah, but you know what the problem is, Ben? They're all going to want you to go out and shoot pheasants for them. The people you have
well,
over.
Well, season's over, so we'll have to wait till next year.
Tough luck, guys. Enjoy.
Thanks much, Lynn.
Take care.
Bye.
You know that public radio takes the concept of culture very seriously. And if you listen to The Splendid Table often, you know that we feel food goes far beyond solely what we put in our mouths. We are dedicated to bringing you the most significant aspects of food, the literary, the artistic, and the scientific. Which brings me to Deborah Henson Conant. She is a harpist. The Boston Globe describes Deborah as a combination of Leonard Bernstein, Steve Tyler, and Xena, the warrior princess. But Deborah has made a significant contribution not only to music, but to food and to art. She has created a museum on the web. It is the Museum of Burnt Food. Well, we have her on the phone. Deborah, welcome to the Splendid Table.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted.
Well, Deborah, tell me about the Museum of Burnt Food.
You mean, like, how it started or what?
Yeah, that would be a good place to start.
Well,
yeah.
It started with a phone call, actually. It was an act of providence, I guess. I was heating up some hot apple cider, and I got a phone call, and I ran to the other room to get it, and it was someone I never expected to hear from. And so we talked and talked and talked, and about an hour later, I smelled something odd, and I went to the kitchen and was completely filled with smoke, down to about my waist. So I opened the windows, and then when I came back about an hour later, there on the stove in the middle of the pot was the most exquisite thing I had ever seen. It was about 6 inches high and about 4 inches in diameter, and it was hot, freestanding hot apple cider. Beautiful.
It's an artistic achievement.
It was an absolute revelation. And I thought that, and so, you know, I put it on display and I looked at it and admired it. And it wasn't until several years later that I realized that I was collecting more and more burnt food, even to the point that at one point I had no more pots left because they'd all been burnt in the process of creating this art accidentally.
All right, give me some examples.
I think one of my favorite ones is the, it's called But Is He Jewish? It's a bagel that has been completely burnt. I would call it bagel noir. And it's a gift from, actually a gift from somebody from the Benveniste Carbon Dating Society. And some of the others that I have are the Forever Shrimp Kebab and the Well Done Donut and a Study in Pizza Toast, which is six beautifully matched pizza masterpieces behind glass. And one of my other all-time favorites is the Sweet Potato Surprise, which was, it was a surprise because I didn't realize I was cooking anything at all. I had forgotten that the sweet potatoes were in the oven, and they cooked for about 5 weeks when I went down to Mexico on a very low heat. It was actually just the pilot light. And when I came back, it was a surprise. I opened it up, and there was art.
Do other artists contribute to the museum?
Yes. Yes, we have several things on loan. In fact, one of the other things that I love is I have a second hot apple cider, which is actually in its natural habitat. It's in a pot that it was burnt in, and it was donated by an artist and a scientist, a guy named Gary Dreyfus. And when he gave it to me in a beautiful ceremony, he said this had happened because he had fallen asleep. And that's how his hot apple cider happened. And when he gave it to me, he said, you know, it's wonderful to wake up and realize that art has happened.
With that thought, Deborah, I want to thank you. You've inspired us.
Thank you so much.
Perhaps you may find more contributions coming to you.
Well, I'm always open for more contributions. And people can see the virtual museum on the website.
Deborah, you opened up a whole new vista for all of us.
I hope so.
This is brilliant.
Thank you so much. Well, I figure, you know, Julia Child only lives, 2 miles from here?
Well, she would want to make a contribution, I bet.
She might. Or I feel that I sort of need to compensate, you know, for how great she is.
Just remember, behind every great cook are many burnt offerings.
Is that really true?
Oh, I think so. You learn by mistakes.
That's a great quote. Behind every great cook
are many burnt offerings.
Is that something you always say?
No, I just made it up this moment.
Well, that's going in the museum.
I'm very proud.
And I will quote you from The Splendid Table.
Thank you, Deborah.
Well, thank you.
Harpist Deborah Henson is the curator of the Burnt Food Museum. You can find information on it on our website at splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for today, everybody. Thanks for being with us. Remember, you can call us at any time. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with an observation from Oscar Wilde that I find particularly reassuring, since early morning is not my best time. Wilde said, "Only dull people are brilliant at breakfast." The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the only place you can register for kitchen essentials, nonstick, hard anodized cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.